Welcome to Slated to Discuss, a podcast exploring trends, developments, and issues shaping the world of real estate and infrastructure. Hosted by Slate Asset Management, a global real asset investor and manager, this podcast will feature original, forward-thinking, and even unconventional perspectives from experts and trailblazers, interviewed by a rotation of Slate leaders. Head to slateam.com, where you can subscribe to the Slated to Discuss podcast on your favorite platform, learn more about Slate's real estate, infrastructure, and securities capabilities, and discuss any of the ideas you hear on today's episode. Now, over to your host, Bojana Jankowska, Managing Director and Head of ESG at Slate.
Welcome to the third episode of Slated to Discuss. In today's episode, we'll be diving into the crucial link between climate risk, insurance, and real estate, and its broader impact on financial markets and governance. We have two exceptional guests joining us who bring a wealth of knowledge and experience in the fields of ESG and climate risk. First up, we have Rachel Norris, based right here in London. Rachel leads the global real estate and construction practice ESG offering at Loctum, the world's largest independent insurance brokerage. With an impressive 20 years in real estate insurance, Rachel has worked across all industry verticals, collaborating with asset managers, fund managers, property owners, managing agents, sovereign wealth funds, and REITs. Next, we are delighted to welcome David Whittle, who joins us from Montreal. David is at the helm of the climate risk practice at ClearSum, a strategic advisory firm focused on climate risk strategy. His experience spans various sectors, including real estate and finance. With a career that has taken him from Hong Kong to San Francisco and now Montreal, David brings a global perspective to investment and risk management. We're thrilled to have both Rachel and David here today to share their insights, experiences, and perspectives on ESG and climate risk. Let's dive right in. Hi, Rachel. Hi, David. Welcome to the podcast. It's great to have you on.
Hey, Bojana. Nice to see you again, David.
Hi, Bojana. Hi, Rachel. It's great to see you.
So today we should have a quite interesting topic, which I personally feel isn't really being talked about a great deal. And it's looking at climate risk and insurance and financial implications. And I think we've got a quite interesting discussion here ahead of us in terms of the types of topics that we would like to be able to cover. But starting off, let's first of all lay the groundwork for the audience and just get an understanding of how is insurance linked in with climate risk. It may seem a bit obvious, but I think it'll be good to just hear it from both our guests, what that actually looks like from both their perspectives. So starting with you, Rachel, what does climate risk and insurance look like at the moment for the real estate sector? And why is the real estate sector particularly exposed?
Real estate assets, including whether that's residential, commercial, industrial properties, are all exposed to a wide range of climate-related hazards. So this could be anything from physical damage, disruption operations, and potentially reduce the values of long-term assets, especially when our clients look to go and sell their assets. So insurance, and that's very much the area that I'm focusing on, plays a critical role in helping property owners mitigate financial risks associated with climate hazards. So this would be done in terms of insurance brokers like myself and insurance companies providing solutions for property damage, business interruption, liability, and other losses coming from this. So when you look at risk factors such as location, building characteristics, risk exposures, market conditions in the insurance world, we need to consider some really key points, especially when we look at this on a really global scale. And I'm sure David has lots to talk about on this point as well. What we really need to look at is the availability of insurance cover, affordability and adequacy of insurance coverage itself, and all of the nuances that go alongside it, because sometimes you do need to navigate that with your broker.
Great, Rachel. And David, what's your perspective on this?
Yeah, I think Rachel's covered the insurance risk in particular, but maybe taking a step back and looking just at the climate risk that is somewhat unique to the property and real estate sector because of its fixed nature. Let's go back a little bit to the origin of what we're facing. So since the Paris Agreement, despite a lot of progress, we still have an increase in greenhouse gas emissions. We still have increases in global temperatures. And what that means is we have more frequent and more severe climate hazards, such as extreme precipitation, flooding, and wildfires. And real estate as a fixed asset is exposed to those climate hazards and can be especially vulnerable to loss from those risks. There are also transition risks that the real estate sector faces. For example, the policy, legal, technology, and market risks that can accelerate if that gap between the emission cuts that countries have committed to and the emission cuts that are needed persists. So the real estate sector, like many sectors, is going to be faced with changes in technology and policy that constitute what we call transition risks. I would add to that that in addition to the physical risks and the transition risks, there are opportunities. And the opportunities are all in the actions that can be taken by real estate owners and by investors in real estate. And that's through mitigation, adaptation, and resilience that can increase the attractiveness of real estate and properties. It can reduce the costs and make available more insurance to real estate owners who are investing in mitigation and adaptation. It can even reduce the cost of their loans. So there's quite a lot on the opportunity side to add to the conversation.
It comes across to me as it's obviously has to be a delicate balancing act of risks, opportunities, costs, market conditions, and everything else that comes in between. In terms of how the market, insurance market, and even how the financial market has looked and considered at climate change, I mean, clearly we know there's a lot of regulation coming, disclosure regulation coming our way. There's lots of various climate risk assessment tools being built out, some of which the insurance industry has been doing from day dot, because that's the bread and butter. But I'm just curious to hear both your perspectives on what do you see really strong trends that you're starting to see emerge, both with your insurance hat on, Rachel, and then with your financials hat on, David.
So in terms of climate-related insurance losses, this is something that I can really see from my 20 years of experience. So one thing I should say, first of all, in my career, I was very UK-focused, but my spectrum, as you said in your introduction, I do have a global remit. There's definitely increasing frequency and severity to weather events. We've seen that in our claims patterns. We see that in loss runs that we see. We see that in market literature from the insurance market. There's been a shift in risk as well, and I think that's quite an interesting topic to look at. So, for example, regions that historically experienced mild hurricanes may now face more frequent and intense storms due to warming ocean temperatures. Again, that's something we might not have seen previously. We had wildfires on the London-Essex borders. And David from Montreal, that's the London-Essex borders, we should not be seeing wildfires there. But that's something we had to deal with in the last 2 years. Again, that's a really strange thing to actually see. In 2021, we had the horrific floods in Germany. So I think Munich at the time quoted it was going to be about 40 billion of insurance damages. But actually, I think the more important part there was 180 souls lost as a result of those floods. And that's not something, again, that we've really seen in mainland Europe before. We've had lots of flooding in London with basements being damaged. Again, these are new things that we are seeing. I think with milder winters across Europe and the volume of rainfall instead of actually seeing the snow, that will also lead to new types of losses in the coming years. And losses are becoming a lot more complex in this space. So when we see different asset classes, so there's been such an emergence in the last couple of years of these big industrial warehouses or data centers, that actually when we see weather-related events impacting asset classes like that, the damage is so severe. And I always give the example that what people always think when solar panels are installed on the roofs, everyone's worried about the fire associated with the solar panels being on top of the roofs. But actually what you now find, a lot of hail damage is actually really ripping up the solar panels and causing damage that way. So again, it's kind of emerging risks and trends. So I think that's quite interesting. So we've definitely seen a shift in that. And then when we look at how insurance policies are changing to this, so I am not an expert in US real estate, but I know from my colleagues that when we're looking at storm type damage or named storm covers, you might have floating limits. So actually, you may not be covered for a full storm damage. Dutch flood, again, that's such a nuanced cover in the Netherlands that actually there's such a precise definition of this. Actually, quite a lot of the time, you will not be insured for full value from Dutch flood. an earthquake, for example, in Italy could be another type of loss that's not insured to the full value. Japan, again, could be an area where you don't insure for quake to full value because the buildings are built to withstand certain losses. And it's really interesting how all of this fits together. And I think a really interesting point as well is actually the banks and finances. They understand this as well. So when we're looking at a facility agreement, for example, the banks understand that some of this cover is just not available in certain parts of the globe. And actually, probably more importantly, whether it's commercially viable as well.
Those are really interesting points, Rachel. And I like the way you're bringing up all the different regions from London to Montreal to the US, because it highlights the point that climate risk is a systemic risk. And moving maybe a little bit to the regulatory side, one of the points which interests me a great deal is the fact that the Task Force on Climate-Related Financial Disclosures, or the TCFD, was created in 2015 by the Financial Stability Board, the FSB. And the FSB itself was established in 2009 in Switzerland to address global financial stability. The regulatory frameworks that we see developed in the TCFD have their origins in financial supervisory regulation, where we had the experience in 2008 and 2009 of seeing what systemic risk looks like. And we introduced into the vocabulary of risk management the ideas of contagions and institutions, financial institutions that were systemically important because of their linkages and their relationships. And as we look at the financial regulatory frameworks that are emerging today through the IFRS, through their sustainability and climate disclosure standards, and through other standards that are being put forward at the national level, we really see the very similar framework of the financial framework that was developed out of the FSB in 2009. So elements like scenario analysis are really important because in systemic risk, it's not sufficient to simply look at the models and look back at a period of time and extrapolate norms from what was experienced in the recent past. It's more important really to look at what could happen, to ask the question, what if, and to try and stress test different financial models under different climate futures that are plausible. And I think that's very unfamiliar for some people in financial markets who are not accustomed to that type of thinking, but certainly for actors in the insurance sector or in the banking sector, that transition from working more with models that were backward looking, that looked at extrapolations of past trends, and moving more toward regulatory frameworks that include scenario analysis and stress testing are becoming a norm with climate risk that financial participants are going to become more and more exposed to and will have to become more and more familiar with.
Do you think that the forthcoming standardization and consolidation of ESG disclosures, like, for example, TCFD, which you've mentioned, is now rolled up into the IFRS kind of standards and is now being made mandatory in terms of linking the climate risks, ESG risks, to financial? What do you think is going to be needed by, for example, boards, senior management, to be able to scale up, to be able to understand the kind of things they need to be looking up to understand climate change risks, not only in terms of financial implications that has, but also with Rachel here, the nuances around, well, how should we be making up, in the case of real estate, are buildings more resilient? And is that going to have a positive impact at all on the kind of insurance premiums that we will be paying? Maybe not today, but maybe in the future as the market evolves and understands this. So it'd be good perhaps if both of you could elaborate on that and just give your respective views, starting with you, David.
The frameworks, beginning with the TCFD, but moving into IFRS now, are really focused around these four pillars of governance, strategy, risk management, metrics, and targets. And so for your question, one thing that boards are going to become increasingly familiar with is what are the governance structures that are necessary to manage climate risk and climate opportunities? What are the organizational structures that need to be put in place, starting with the establishment of a risk appetite statement, incorporating climate risk into that statement, and then developing metrics and targets that allow an organization to track the progress that they're making toward the achievement of those metrics and targets, having a strategy which is going to involve some type of scenario analysis and stress testing, and a risk management framework which integrates climate risk management into the overall enterprise risk management framework. The standards really are a roadmap that help organizations to see what is the skeleton of that system, what are the pillars, to use the correct terminology, and really to help organizations build that infrastructure and be ready for using that to make themselves more resilient to climate risks.
So let's say if you are a member of a board, climate change is a topic relatively new to you. You know you've got regulations, disclosure regulations coming down the road. How should you be preparing? How would you prepare? What would be the first set of top three questions you'd be asking?
I'd want to know straight away, what are the risks that I'm facing? And I think all of us who are involved in the area of climate risk and in helping companies to understand that play a role in helping organizations understand what is physical risk. How am I exposed to physical risk? What are my vulnerabilities? And what adaptations and resilience measures can I take? What are the transition risks that I face as economies transition toward net zero economies? What type of transition risks do I face? What technologies do I need to invest in? How will policies change? And it's very typically the environmental, social, or governance teams inside of organizations who can help senior management understand what those frameworks are and prepare them through training and discussions to start to take on those questions and build their own expertise on the board. That often happens in the audit committee on a board, but really it's typical to have at least one person who is dedicated to risk management and who also has experience and understanding of climate risk.
That's great. And Rachel, just coming to you on this topic, what are you seeing in terms of when you speak with respective ESG teams within the industry, the real estate industry, how are you seeing them look at risk tools available in the marketplace and the innovations around that to help them help their boards become prepared for these growing need to understand climate risk? What are you seeing then? What are the key questions that you're being asked of real estate investors that you're working with?
Something that I've definitely seen post-pandemic, there's been such a push of data. And I think what I'm definitely seeing is that sometimes clients can be overwhelmed by the amount of data and what data points they should actually be looking at. Because at the end of the day, we are looking at maybe six key elements. I actually jotted this down to make sure I didn't forget any of them. So the floods, heat stress, hurricanes, typhoons, sea level rise, water stress, wildfires, earthquakes. All of those, bar two, always been insured perils, pretty much within a all-risk insurance policy. So actually that part of it is nothing new to most of our clients. So most brokers want to take a lot of modelling. David, yourself correctly said, but it's always been very past-looking. So actually it's about how we amalgamate all of it together, because I think that's actually what the key thing is. It's actually how we bring it all together. And I think, again, Bijani, you made a really good point around an ESG team may look at a certain metric, but is that getting to the asset managers? Is that getting to the construction guys when we're looking at actually what CapEx do we have to consider if we're putting certain measures in? And I actually think my biggest kind of question, my challenge, what makes me creative in this is how you bring it all together. Because if I was sitting on the board, what I really want to know is, okay, so this is my portfolio as it stands. In my mind, I know what my hold period is. What does that actually mean to me in 10 years' time? So can I actually sell the assets in 10 years' time? Can I still get insurance cover for these assets in certain parts of the world? Will the price of the asset be chipped? But actually then, what is the CapEx to fix it? So if it's okay, I'd love to share an example with you both. So we had a client based in the UK. And I always say the UK is quite benign. We don't really have too much going on over here. It's not in like the States or in Asia. So it's slightly different. But this was a 16 asset deal in the south of the UK. Our client had great technical advisors, no issue in terms of flood. Insurance modelling, no issues in terms of flood. And then what transpired was we run climate modelling data over it. And it turned out 12 of the assets were actually going to be at risk from climate change in the future. And it would cost so much money to remedy those assets in terms of CapEx. That client actually decided not to go on with that transaction. And it's not that there was any issues with in terms of actually placing insurance cover for 12 months or maybe 24 months. But actually, the client really took a step back and was like, okay, so this is really interesting. I've got technical advisor, I've got insurance modeling and the climate modeling. How do I bring it all together to make a final decision? And that for me was like the aha moment about how you bring it together and the type of conversations I need to have with my clients about bringing it all together.
Interesting about that, because that's something that we definitely do at Slate when it comes to doing any due diligence at the underwriting acquisition stage. We always do the climate physical risk assessment just to make sure there's nothing there that jumps out at us that we should be aware of, and ask ourselves the same questions as the case study you just mentioned. The one thing I've noticed, however, is that there are quite a lot of climate modeling tools which investors like Slate will have access to. But do you think they are aligning, or do you think depending on the methodologies, you'll get different answers being spat out? Because then it's a matter of pick your poison, isn't it?
I think it's what level of detail you need. So in terms of reporting, again, Dave would be much and best place to talk around what you'd need for reporting purposes. But when I look at the insurance part, actually quite a simplistic review of it is very helpful. So actually, if you can see that maybe 5% of your portfolio is tracking in a red area, and actually, again, that's very rare, because I think one of the unique things with real estate is there's such a spread of risk. It's very rare you ever only look after one or two assets for a client. There's usually multiple assets, multiple countries, multiple parts of the country, and different asset classes as well. So that also helps diversify the risk. But actually, just knowing what your areas of concern are really important. So actually, say, like I say, if you have 5 or 10% that might be in the red, well, actually, what can your insurance broker, what can the likes of Zurich Climate Resilience, what can Chubb Climate Plus, what can they come and do and help you to actually reduce that and mitigate that further? So that's really interesting. So that's been a bit of a shift in the insurance market. We now have these climate teams setting up in insurance companies to really help with that risk control piece. For me, that was a bit that was missing. So you had the data, but you weren't quite sure how to actually fix what the data was saying. So that's been quite interesting as well. But then if you had a real concern of an asset, some of these reporting at the moment are still very expensive. You can pay a lot of money for one report, but that will be a deep dive into a particular property and it will give you chapter and verse on how to fix it. But actually, it could be very good money well spent, actually, if it could end up potentially chipping your asset by a couple of million at the end. All of these parts are so important when we look at the overall picture.
Sticking on this point before I come to David, looking from our perspective, what would we need to be showing in your view to our insurers that we are taking climate risk seriously? This is a topic we've discussed again. Let's say we've decided to spend a ton of money on implementing climate resilience measures at a property which our climate model has told us is particularly exposed to flooding risk. In, let's say, that risk increasing over the next 7 years up to 2030. We know insurance policies are only over 1 year term, but we are looking to spend quite a lot of money with a view to saving that asset in 7 years' time from potential flood risk. So is the funds spent today on resilience measures at properties, is that money well spent?
I think Slate is very good at this. So the fact that actually when something goes to investment committee, you have already done your climate checks on this. So that, again, is a really interesting part we must tell the insurance market. So when we're taking the Slate portfolio globally to market, we must make sure the insurance industry understands the level that you're going into. We've done lots of work around the portfolio and we've had various data to come back on it. So I think that's a really key thing, is that we have to make sure the insurance industry and insurers understand what our clients are doing in this space. And you're right, insurance contracts on the whole offer 12 months. Okay, you may get 24, 36 months, it's a long-term deal, but actually the liabilities are curtailed to a very short period. When you give the example of flood, if you are spending X amount on flood mitigation measures, that absolutely is something that we need to be telling insurers about, because what we need to make sure is not only they're aware of this, so the asset's protected, then we would send our own risk engineers down, insurance engineers would also go as well. Because we want to make sure that if you've spent X amount in CapEx to protect your location, that you have full insurance coverage on there, or there might be a slight increased excess. But what we can't be in a position of is that you don't have the insurance coverage because they don't understand that actually what you've done in terms of risk mitigation. And that's a really key point. sharing that knowledge again is absolutely critical. At the end of the day, and this is something I think, David Brajano, you may have heard me say before, is that nobody wants an asset that is damaged. So you as a real estate owner doesn't, the tenant absolutely doesn't, the insurance industry doesn't. The insurance industry is there to pick up the losses in the event something happens. But everybody wants that building to be as resilient as possible and carry on trading. So actually, the risk mitigations that you're putting in are absolutely critical to future coverage.
That's fantastic. Really good insights here. And David, I just want to come to you now because I want to pick your brains a little bit more about thinking about this with your financial hat on, with a financial perspective. So let's say I'm in the finance team for one of our funds or a fund. Suddenly, I'm told that I need to look at climate risk. How on earth do I start thinking about that? Do you have any thoughts or views in terms of starting that approach? And given where regulations are going, the climate disclosure regulations, TCFD, IFRS now, what do you think investors, when it comes to integrating climate risks into financial models, valuations, capital business planning, how should they be thinking about this? And what are the key questions they should be asking their teams, their ESG teams, to help them understand?
Let's scale out for a moment, and I'm going to try to link some of these themes up. First, climate risk, as we've established, is systemic, and there is a difference between direct climate risk and indirect climate risk. And think about some of the recent climate events that we've seen around the world. Think about Lahaina, and think about how a wildfire has affected so many different parts of that community. And it may be that the buildings, when you look at the map and you look at the images that you see the buildings, you see the impact on hotels and houses and other structures that we think about as real estate investors. But there are also all of the related services that make those buildings valuable. And not just services, but attributes of the area which were affected by the event. If we were to use that lens and look at a new project and say, what are the climate risks? We can't concern ourselves only with the risk to the asset itself. We have to ask the question, in addition to the direct risk to the asset, what are the other revenue generating attributes of this asset? What is the community around the asset and what is its vulnerability? What are the services that are required to keep this building operating? Where are the sources of power and electricity? Where are the roads or metro systems that bring people to this building so that they can use the building as it was designed to be used? So risk extends well beyond the direct physical risk to the asset. And real estate investors need to be aware of that as they're asking themselves the question, what risks do I face from climate change over the long-term horizon for this long-term asset? This is a long-lived asset designed to be in service for decades, not years. So that's one thing, it's the perspective that your investment professional within your organization would want to have as they're addressing this. And then we could scale in. So I was scaling up to the macro there. We could scale into the micro and really just focus on your income statement and balance sheet and say, well, for the real estate investor, let's start with revenue. I want to maximize my occupancy and I want to maximize the rental rates that I can achieve. And if I have a building, which is, let's call it climate ready, meaning I've made the adaptive investments that I need to make. I've put all of the investments in place that I need to mitigate the emissions that this building was going to produce or previously produced. I've put in adaptive measures against future climate risks. Those are investments that I no longer have to make in the future. And an occupant coming and looking at that building will find that building relatively more attractive. A buyer even more so, because those are investments the buyer won't have to make. Tenants in commercial buildings are interested in the indirect emissions that they're going to be accountable for in that building. So a building that has low emissions will be more attractive to a tenant than a building that has higher emissions. So sticking with that micro view of the income statement and focusing on revenue, if I'm a member of an investment team, I want to contemplate investments that are going to make my building more attractive, that are going to maximize occupancy and achieve the highest possible rentals. And climate resilience and climate mitigation have a role in that area. Moving down to costs, if I've made those investments, it may be easier for me to obtain insurance. I may even get a preferential rate in my insurance because I have made those investments. Number two, moving down a little bit further down the income statement, when it comes time to finance future investments or even the building itself, I may be eligible for sustainability-linked loans and sustainability-linked finance because of the investments I've made or because of the care I've taken in thinking about the location of this building with respect to climate risks. So working down the income statement in a micro sense, members of real estate teams and teams of people who own real estate assets can be thinking in terms of each of these line items and then thinking about how they affect the overall value of the building. So a building that is climate ready, that has access to insurance, perhaps to lower premium rates, has access to sustainability linked loans and financing, and which can achieve higher occupancy rates and higher rental rates, is just going to be a more attractive building. From a financial analyst perspective, those are the elements we would consider at the micro level.
This is like the ideal world scenario. But Rachel, go ahead.
David's so insightful on this topic, and I think there's something that's really key here. So David's talking about this topic, but how often does someone come to an insurance broker and actually say this? And actually, sometimes I think insurance may get forgotten in this, but you've heard me say this again, Brijana. This is intrinsically linked to risk management. So actually, if we are onboarding a new asset that's had everything that David has spoken about, that is exactly how I would go in and broke that deal. I would say, look at all of the measures that have been put into this building. Mr. Insurer, we want to see this preferential rate and making sure we've got maximum amount of cover on there. But then that also then leads to something I think just as exciting. Is in the event something does happen to that building, how can we have a net zero claim outcome? How can we build back greener again if something happens to that building? There's so many different terms and conditions in a policy that so often you can actually build back greener and stronger in the event something happens. And that's the type of asset that you want to deploy that on, even if it's a green fund. So actually insurers quite often will provide risk management funds for risk resilience. So actually, could we change it into a green fund for a portfolio that has all of those topics that David spoke about? David started speaking, it got me thinking about what more we could do in that space.
Yeah, I mean, also makes me realize, just speaking and just listening to the both of you, how much a learning curve the different players have still got to come up to really understand how this is relevant to their day-to-day job, whether it's somebody sitting in the finance team, whether it's somebody brokering and negotiating insurance, the next insurance contract, whether it's somebody sitting in the asset management team doing the capital business planning round, linking that all together. In order to do it effectively, you need to be able to have the knowledge, be upskilled, to be able to know when to include it, how to think about it, what the different nuances are. And I still feel that there's still quite a lot of work to be done across the industry and across the different teams. I often forget that ESG is not the bread and butter of people's jobs. It is mine because that's what I'm paid to do and that's what I do all day. So for me, it is my bread and butter. But I think sometimes I just forget that ESG is just one of the many items that people need to be thinking about on a day-to-day basis. But I think that is now starting to become, certainly from what I've seen over the years that I've been in the sector, something that's risen up people's agenda and is starting to come to the fore because of all the different changes happening in the industry, the regulatory requirements, the pressures on board, the pressures on management, the pressures on return. This brings me on to that final two set of questions in our discussion. Just as I was listening to you, I was just thinking about incentives. What kind of incentives do you think the insurance sector could be thinking about to encourage insurance buyers to be more sustainable? Because it feels like that's currently not happening at the moment to any great extent. And the insurance industry is really exposed to climate risk. You would want them to be pulling forward products and policies that actually encourage people to be doing all the measures they need to be doing to be more climate resilient. But do you see that actually in terms of incentives? And David, I would also like to get your thoughts on this as well in terms of financial incentives, linking ESG performance, climate risk performance to remuneration. How have you seen that evolve over your time in the industry? So Rachel, why don't you first have a stab?
In terms of where we are at the moment, and again, we've kind of touched on this, the fact that lots of insurance and real estate programs up to 12-month contracts. I think in a way we need to take a step back, is actually we need to look at where all claims are coming from. So still the vast majority of insurance programs, underwriters are looking at fire risk and escape of water. They are still our most common perils, albeit the weather-related perils could end up being substantially more unless you have a total burn. So I think there's one thing about actually an education within the insurance market about why we need to understand all of this, because at the end of the day, everybody wants long-term customers. The ideal position is that you have a relationship with an insurance carrier in some form for many, many years, because they will look after you in the event of maybe a tricky claim, whether it's innovation and products. Having those relationships is absolutely critical. But in terms of true incentives at the moment, we're not seeing a 10% discount, for example, if you're doing this, this, and this. That I do think will change over time. I really do. But actually, having said the part around the fire and escape of water, which I absolutely stand by, is if you can present to an insurance company that actually, say, for example, you have 50 assets on your portfolio and every single property has risk mitigation for climate, there will definitely be something in there. What that means is actually you can potentially open yourself up to new insurance carriers. There's now ESG syndicates, definitely within the London market. Reinsurance may have a play in this as well. So I think at the moment, it's very embryonic. I think we're definitely on a journey at the moment. And the thing that we really need to do is upskill a lot of people in this area and then back it up by the data as well. So I know that we're starting to run some data projects ourselves and actually looking at how the claims data in terms of climate losses impacts our overall portfolios and then what the end outcomes are as well. So it's early days, but I do think it will change as more people understand this topic in depth.
Really interesting. I think the framework that you are right at the front of, Bojena, as an ESG expert, of bringing information about disclosures to your company and making disclosures is always the starting point. And most companies that I have worked with in any way initially find that very challenging. And the question often comes up, why am I being asked to make disclosures? You asked me about remuneration. Why are we making disclosures about tied remuneration to climate outcomes or to environmental, social, and governance outcomes? A link, a very important link to insurance, is insurance companies are in the business of pricing risk. And in the absence of really clear information that's going back to what we discussed earlier, historical trends and data information, insurance companies and other players need to gather more and more information for risks that are a little bit more abstract and difficult to comprehend. And the starting point is the data that companies disclose. Stepping back a little bit and looking at the framework works which are being developed, we are going to have a large volume of new information that we can use to compare companies one to the other to understand, what investments are you really making? How does that compare with your sector? How does that compare with other companies in your region? How focused is your management team on those investments? And we can track those things based on compensation linkages. So there are really important reasons why these disclosures have been developed the way they've been developed. And I think that the starting point in many organizations is the ESG team, who, by understanding the disclosures and sharing that information internally, start to train the whole team about the value of those disclosures. Insurance companies are going through the same process. They're learning as well. They're having to make disclosures themselves. But using those disclosures gives them more levers to price risk, to think about ways to compare risk, and to slice and dice it, and to look at it in more granular frameworks that help them at the margin to make risk-based pricing decisions.
How much is on the shoulders of ESG teams? Because the complexities of understanding all the different nuances of ESG, from regulatory to disclosure to technological innovation, it is a lot to manage within that ESG team. Well, not manage, but to be on top of, which is why it's so important that teams like we at Slate really work closely with teams and integrate ESG into how teams are thinking. And it is coming back to that point we made earlier, is the upskilling of people and getting them to actually understand why this is relevant, why it matters, what things are relevant to them. You can't expect everybody to be looking at everything, but it's just like, focus, this is what you should be focusing on, this is what's important to you. But it's a big task, and often ESG teams are under-resourced or are small. But it's all about finding the right partners and the right ears. And I think there is opportunity to really integrate ESG into the firm if you do it in the right way. And that is engaging people from day dot. If you're introducing change, because ESG is change management in a shape and form, and bringing people along is key. So understanding the architecture of change management. So it's going to be an interesting journey, which kind of brings me to the next point. Interesting journeys, looking to the future. What's on the horizon? What is your thing that you think is going to be emerging that perhaps is not a big topic now, but you're starting to see initial seeds of it starting to take hold? What's the next thing on the horizon that we need to be thinking about in addition to what we've just discussed today? Rachel, why don't you kick off?
I thought about this as we're coming to the summing up. And there's a few points that I think in terms of emerging challenges and what we need to look to the future. So one is navigating changing climate patterns. And I think that's a constant learning and understanding that's really, really important. In my world, is making sure losses, so claims, are adjusted quickly, including repair payments, and actually you can get people to site really quickly, and how you build back stronger. So that point I made before, I think that's really important. And actually making sure we have loss adjusters that understand how to do these new climate losses, because again, these are new things that we're seeing. Using data properly, again, is really key, and I guess kind of one of the key points we've said today. Taking lessons learned globally, I'm a really big believer in that. I think that if you can learn about something in a certain part of the world, okay, there's always different kind of conditions, but how you can navigate that globally and protect, especially a business like Slate, you have such a global footprint. How to take the risk resilience from your US portfolio into Germany, into Norway. Again, that's a really big thing for me. Using technology to help with the unknown. Again, I think this is a really interesting topic. I'm a big fan of how we can put technology into our insurance programs. And I think Lockton are coming up with some creative points on that. So kind of watch this space. We're doing something quite cool on that. I think just to wrap this up for me, it's all about the collaboration between the real estate owner, the broker, and the insurer. That for me, if we can do a bit more of that, I think we're on a good track to go forward.
Sounds great. And David, what are your final words of wisdom that you want to leave our audience with?
I too think that collaboration is a big part of this. It's because climate risk is a systemic risk that we have so many interdisciplinary teams looking at the problem. Thinking of your audience who are interested in real estate and interested as well in insurance and other elements of what real estate investors have to think about. I think that for those who are already involved in the sector or those who are making new steps within the sector, the realization about how open the different partners, whether it's your insurance partner, your banking partner, there are new innovations taking place all the time that require this type of collaboration where asset owners go to their insurers and go to their bankers and say, I'm contemplating making these investments. I'm contemplating making my organization more resilient in this way or reducing our impact on the climate in this way. How does that fit with what you're trying to achieve at your organization? And the learnings there and the opportunities to develop and innovate are really significant. It's the most enjoyable and promising part of being involved in climate work. I mean, even this conversation we're having, three people from three really quite different parts of the ecosystem, all working on very similar problems and coming out of a call like this with new ideas about how organizations like ours could collaborate in different ways. That is at the heart of it. So collaboration, I will agree with Rachel, is probably the big opportunity for the sector, for real estate investors, looking at all the different partners they have, whether it's insurance or banking or elsewhere.
That's great. And I think I would add communication to collaboration. Maybe the two is part of the same side of the coin, but I think lots of things can get lost in translation, and being clear on your communication, making sure that everybody's collaborating, understands what the end goal is or where we're trying to go. And so I think collaboration and communication are the two key skills that I think everybody's skilling up on. You can never get enough of that, in my view. So on that note, I would love to thank both Rachel and David for a fascinating discussion, and for giving up your time to join us today on the Slate to Discuss podcast. It's been wonderful having you both, and I look forward to future collaboration and communication with you both. Over and out.
You've been listening to Slated to Discuss, hosted by Slate Asset Management. Slate Asset Management is a global alternative investment platform targeting real assets. We are creatives, collaborators, entrepreneurs, and innovators who are looking to make a difference in the communities in which we invest. To learn more about Slate, explore our firm's real estate, infrastructure, and securities capabilities, and connect with us further to discuss any of the topics we touch on in our podcast, head over to slateam.com. We'll see you next time on Slated to Discuss.